Okay.
We kind of try to go back and dissect how we got to where we are and maybe revisit the point of the discussion that we had from my perspective, and then everyone else is free to give their perspective. It's obvious we have a lot of different views here. Just keying in on that statement that came out of the Groundfish Advisory Panel report. It speaks to some of the frustrations that I've spoken about independently with you and sit here at the microphone, that concerned about our ability to implement a plan on time, and clearly we're not able to. That's why we have an interim action. So, for various reasons that we don't need to repeat, but we've slipped, and I continue to be concerned about our ability to implement Amendment 16 on time. We just got a report today that the timeline is pushed back till June for a final decision. That's about 11 months before the fishery is supposed to start in 2010. If you look at what's in the plan, there's sector allocation and all the requirements that go along with sector allocation, the monitoring component, the actual allocation of the fishery. There's an effort control component as well, which is predicated on the same tools, the same toolbox that we have used forever in this plan. And over the past two plus years, people continue to write about what's wrong with how we're doing things from different perspectives. And I went back into Amendment 13, and then I went into Amendment 16 draft document over lunch. And that frustration is highlighted in the plan. It's right there in the text. It says, this is in reference to Amendment 13. The management measures adopted by the amendment, Amendment 13, to reduce mortality were necessary and are also expected to reduce fishing mortality unnecessarily on other healthy stocks. As a result of these lower fishing mortality rates, yield from healthy stocks is sacrificed, and the management plan may not provide optimum yield, which is the amount of fish that will provide the greatest overall benefit to the nation. We've also gotten reports through the development of this amendment of the what's termed the assumed discard rate on a species-by-species basis. There's been a lot of opinion pieces written in newspapers up and down the coast. We heard today from a member of the public that one of the primary failures of the way we're managing is that we create regulatory discards. Council members have spoken to their frustrations over being managed or being boxed in by the lowest common denominator. I share those concerns, and I think everyone else here does as well. I think that it's very easy to get hung up on what's going wrong. It's not always easy to figure out how to make it right. But this is the place that that has to happen. We're the ones that can turn this around. We're the ones that can make decisions to improve and to take advantage of some of the hard work and some of the decisions that we've made. But we can't do that if we continue to use the same tools. There's also going to be a transition period, which is going to be a confusing period for many people. And in that transition, there's going to be a need to build new systems and allocate existing resources and perhaps new resources to support this transition and these new systems, this new way of doing business. the promise of making this transition is to increase the profitability of fishing while conserving those resources and rebuilding those stocks that need rebuilding. As it says in one of our amendments, it's impossible to design measures that will selectively change mortality for individual species. It's impossible to use input controls to be that surgical. We had a motion up on the board earlier that was, and I guess still is, a little too broad. But it got the discussion going. It got the discussion out on the table. With respect to Amendment 16, you've got sectors and common pool. We haven't had a big discussion about the common pool. We spent a fair amount of time talking about sectors and how they're going to operate. All sectors are allowed to ask for an exemption from days at sea. I would anticipate most would, if not all. What about the common pool? Well, the common pool in our document right now is managed with days at sea and trip limits. We also, as Dr. Pierce pointed out, are awaiting the final guidelines on National Standard 1, which hopefully will clarify how ACLs and AMs should be applied. We have statutory requirements to have ACLs and AMs in place in 2010 or 2011. This council's made a decision to do it in this amendment in 2010 because most of the stocks we have need that in 2010. So what about the common pool? Who's in the common pool? Well, we don't know. Why don't we know? Well, we don't know who's going to be in the sectors. Well, why don't we know who's going to be in the sectors? Well, because we don't know what we're going to get in a sector. We don't know what the allocation decision is going to be. I don't know if I'm better off in a common pool under an input control system or if I'm better off in the sector. We have a range of allocation alternatives in the document that we've worked on. We haven't talked about them in, I think, about a year. It's not something we like to talk about. But that's really how people are going to make their decision. I'm either in the common pool or in the sector. And I'm going to base that decision on whatever seems to me at the time to be the more profitable route. People also aren't committing to sectors because of a concern over what is it am I getting into? Am I liable for the actions of someone else? And we've had that discussion and we'll continue to have that discussion. People aren't sure they want to join a sector because of the cost. You got to pay for a manager, you got to pay for an EA, you got to pay for a whole bunch of other costs that the council may hurl on sectors. Those are valid concerns. So maybe I'm better off sticking in the common pool. But don't forget that no matter which avenue you go down as a permit holder, there's a limit to how many fish can come out of the ocean in a given year. Now, we may choose not to use a management system that shuts off fishing in a given year when that limit's hit. But we're going to have to get much better at reacting year on year when those limits are exceeded and make corrective changes. If we continue to rely on days at sea and trip limits, we're going to continue to have the same problems and we're going to continue to have the same loss of yield over here and horrible discard over here. Now, my suggestion is that the council understand and embrace that and say that the overarching mechanism or control on mortality and to achieve rebuilding will be a hard tack in Amendment 16. That doesn't mean that we have to have an effort control system for the common pool that shuts the common pool off in that year. It means that we have to have a mechanism that makes that adjustment or that accounting the following year. The sectors, by definition, are supposed to be accountable to their TACs and are supposed to shut down in a given year if they meet one of their tacks or find a way to trade ACE intersectorally within the year. I think this debate is really about what are we doing with the common pool, which could be most or all the fishermen or very few fishermen. People have a choice to go to sectors, and they have a choice to stay in a common pool. We're not debating whether or not that choice doesn't exist in this amendment. What we're debating is how we're going to treat the common pool and how we're going to react to the opportunities that are available to fishermen. Are we going to continue to try to manage how efficient or inefficient they are? Are we going to continue to try to make decisions for them, or are we going to free them up to make decisions for themselves and be more concerned with whether or not they live within limits that we don't have very much choice on anymore? So I think Doug has a motion to substitute.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I do. I would like to make a substitute motion that it is the intent of the New England Fisheries Management Council to manage groundfish based on the best available science and move towards an output-based management system.
Is there a second? Seconded by Dave Preble. Discussion.
I basically tried to put together some of the key points we were debating around today, try to narrow it, make sure we had groundfish in there and the output-based management system in there. And I also gathered from the discussion that for a lot of people it was important to reiterate that we're going to manage on the best available science, even though that's clearly stated within Magnuson.
Dr. Pierce.
All right, to make sure I understand exactly what you're getting at, Doug, are you saying essentially that Amendment 17, the one we will work on after we're through with 16, Amendment 17 will involve output-based management system? Of course, there's a wide range of output-based management approaches. I'm assuming you're talking about LAPPs, that you're talking about ITQs. That's what we would envision for Amendment 17. That's the way I'm interpreting this right now. When you say move towards, I'd like to do it while I'm alive, and that would be Amendment 17, which would be implemented probably sometime when, 2000? I guess I'll be around still. 2012, whenever. Is that what you're thinking? By moving towards, we're looking at the next decade and the next amendment, as opposed to our tinkering with Amendment 16 right now, which, of course, we're going to adopt next month. That's what the schedule says, which is why I have a problem with our tinkering with what we have in the amendment right now, with all its flaws, pluses and minuses. It's almost a done deal, except, of course, for the interim action, which is separate and distinct. But still, I mean, we have trimesters for the common pool, target TACs, trimesters. Will that work? Going to be tough, but they're not hard quotas. They're still target TACs and sectors. We're going to learn a lot through implementation of Amendment 16, especially how well all these sectors will work and, of course, how well the common pool functions. So That's my question. Are you talking about the next amendment as opposed to our tinkering with Amendment 16?
Well, Dave, the reason that the word "move towards" was because I feel within this applies partially to Amendment 16, but ultimately to Amendment 17 also. The reason I said move towards because with sectors, which is currently in Amendment 16, that is an output-based system. But clearly at this point, because we are in a transition period with Amendment 16, that we can't say that we're going to move totally towards an output-based system in Amendment 16. So that was the intent, is that we are moving towards, with Amendment 16 being one step, and that our ultimate goal would be something with Amendment 17 to go to a total output-based system.
Terry Stockwell.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. This motion makes me feel a whole lot more comfortable than the one we had before lunch. And I'm glad to hear that the intent is to move towards the output-based system in Amendment 17. And I don't know if Doug would consider a friendly to add that in Amendment 17 at the end of the sentence. To add after management system in Amendment 17.
As long as the council is clear on the intent that we are moving partially towards that system and under Amendment 16, I think we're already there. But
second or agree? Anything further? Go to the audience. Maggie?
Maggie Raymond. Isn't this the exact motion that the council passed a few meetings ago about what they were going to do in Amendment 17?
I think it's very similar. Anyone else in the audience? Back to the council. I'm not sure why we have to make this statement. And I guess I'll be a little more bold or blunt. If this motion aside, if we don't at the very least strongly telegraph, this is my opinion, if we don't strongly telegraph that Amendment 16 is going to utilize hard TACs, and we wait until June, which is I think when we're scheduled now to take the final vote, and people are already saying, well, that may not happen either. We may get delayed even further. Then my concern is that the service will not know what the final decision is going to be. It could be 50 people in sectors and the balance in the common pool, or it could be 600 permits in sectors. We don't know. Then I think we won't have the opportunity to actually engage the service in a meaningful dialogue about how to make the transition as smooth as possible. And I don't blame them for that, because why would they make assumptions on whether or not we're going down a hard tack road or we're going to stay with an input control road? And I think we've lost an opportunity to make the transition smoothly, and we could possibly find ourselves under another year of an interim action, if that's even possible. We may lose control of the amendment or the management of this fishery. But And perhaps I'm not articulating myself well at this point. I had Mark Gibson's hand up, and then Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was going to suggest that we had not answered the question that you had laid out in your introductory remarks as to what happens with the general pool, general category, non-sector participants. I don't think that's been answered. And it's my view that if you don't have a hard tack backing that group up, since we don't know how big it's going to be, but it could be substantial, don't have a hard tack backing that up, an output-based control system in Amendment 16, you run the risk of that being a large segment of the fishery and not meeting the mortality targets and achieving other objectives. So I didn't see that your question was answered, and I don't see that Amendment 16, they have the guidance yet that they need.
Pierce.
Okay, I appreciate your frankness. Now I think I know where you're going. You're suggesting that we change the common pool approach in Amendment 16 and make it a hard quota, not a target quota, broken down by quarters, I suppose, or by trimesters. Fine enough. If that indeed is what you are suggesting, then I would offer the opinion that this was the perfect meeting to suggest that because of the irony created by that suggestion and the fact that we have this book. It was made available to us yesterday by two famous individuals. I know they're famous because I worked with them back when I was a little boy doing all of this in the 1970s, Spencer Apollonio and Jacob Dykstra. An enormous, immensely complicated intervention, Groundfish, the New England Fishery Management Council, and the World Fisheries Crisis. I haven't read it yet, but I lived it. I suggest that if we did what you suggest we do, a hard TAC for the common pool, that we will indeed revisit this. It will be history revisited. I don't want to go there, especially at this late date when we're about to adopt this document, I assume is scheduled in November. Maybe there'll be some postponement of that. We need to get to Amendment 17, transition from the sector management approach with the hard TACs and the common pool approach with the target TACs to an output-based management system that may be ITQ. I'm investigating that myself. I mean, we're all seeing the writing on the wall here as to how this is going to evolve. I appreciate your concerns. You're right on target relative to those concerns. I don't mean to indicate otherwise, but hard TAC for the common pool without there being some allocation strategy to deal with a common pool is disastrous and a repeat of everything that happened described so well in this book. To tell those individuals now that have thought that they would be in the common pool after all these months, you're in the common pool, okay, and the document indicates trimester, target TACs, and all the rest. To tell them now, oh, by the way, you're going to be managed with a hard TAC, I don't see how we can go in that direction. I think that would be a tremendous disservice to the industry that has been following us so closely and having to make a hard decision, very hard decision, about whether to get into sectors. And many have not gotten into sectors for a number of very good reasons. They would like to remain in the common pool. Now they would be told, common pool with a target TAC or sectors. I just think it upsets the apple cart tremendously. And I really don't see how we can go there for Amendment 16.
Dave Gethel.
Yeah. I could support this if we did some other things. If you put in a hard tack on the common pool, but you allow sectors to be self-selecting, you put people in an impossible position. Because all the sectors are currently controlled by member groups. In other words, you have to be a member of a group to be in one of the sectors. And so that leaves all the people who aren't members of a group out in an impossible position. They either end up in something with a hard tack, in which case, having been one of the people who lived through the hard tack disaster in the 70s, and saw everything wrong that happened under that program, it's just impossible. Because there's going to be a derby, there's going to be a race to fish, people are going to get killed. especially guys in small boats who are going to try and fish whenever this opens up, wherever they're allowed to fish, because they can't, they may not be able to join the sector. The sectors are self-selected. Suppose nobody wants you. What are you going to do? If we make the sectors so they have to take anybody that applies, I don't have a problem with it. Because I think then everybody will join the sector. But if the sectors are self-selected and I can say, oh, I like you, you're my buddy, you can come. I don't like you, or maybe I'm going to charge you $50,000 to join because I really don't like you very much. And I'm going to try and keep you out by charging a fee. To me, that's disgusting. And that's where we are right now. And so we've got to decide if we're going to put a statement in here about hard tax, we've got to decide whether or not sectors can stay self-selected.
Tom Neese, then Jim Arlen.
Yeah, just a quick clarification. The comment's been made a couple times that current document includes two versions of accountability measures for the common pool. One version is a hard tack backstop with quarterly tax and closures of areas as those tacks are reached. It is not a target tack. The other version of the accountability measure is one I referred to earlier today, still needs some additional development, but is basically an adjustment to days at sea in the following year based on how well the ACLs are approached or not approached.
That was one of the points, what Tom just described as the second option. If I thought the second option he described, which was a tack that has a payback either in days or in quota the following year, that's a whole different story because it eliminates the potential of an Olympic fishery. And we can't have an Olympic fisheries. We know what happens to that. We can't have it divided by quarters or by week or whatever. It just doesn't work. So if we're talking about something that is semi-soft, I guess, I don't know, that you have a payback provision, that's a whole different animal and would change my thinking. That's one point. The second issue is that we've cut off sectors. We cut it off. You're only going to accept the sectors that have applied. I think that's what the letter from the service has told us. Now, if we're going to go back and tell people, you thought you were going to be under days at sea, it was going to be this way, now it's going to be this way, then we need to reopen that up. That's all I'm saying, is because it's not right to keep those people from forming a sector, which is what the service has said in the letter, that we won't accept any more sectors. So we've got a few issues in the wind here that we need to think about if we're going to take this on in 16. Those are my only points. If it's a payback provision, that changes things. If it's going to open up, then we need, if we're going to have it hard, then we need to open up the common pool to form more sectors. Because right now they can't. And that's not right. Thank you.
Pat.
Well, first, I was going to raise the same point that Tom did, and actually I'm not sure it's a, I think it might be better characterized as an effort control measure than as an accountability measure, because I had understood anyway that the intent was that this could be, that the hard tack that's in there could be implemented as one of the alternatives under Amendment 16 and not just as a measure that's triggered as a result of exceeding the ACL. So I think we just need to be clear about that. And if I'm misunderstanding, then I do think it would be worthwhile for the council to revisit that question. I don't think the motion as it's – well, one more thing before I get to that, I guess. On the sectors, we didn't close off formation of sectors. The council decided that there would be no more new sectors. However, we reopened the opportunity for people to either leave or join the sectors, as I understand it. So there is still that possibility of getting in and out again. And then finally, I think this motion would confuse things instead of clarify things with the addition of in Amendment 17, because then we clearly haven't said where we're going with Amendment 16, and almost implied that we're not going to do some of these things in Amendment 16. We're going to wait till Amendment 17. So if the goal is to provide some guidance to the industry, then I think we need to rethink the wording of the motion again. I know that I think it was Peter who said earlier that the industry just wants to know that the council's moving towards sectors, that they've definitely embraced the concept of sectors anyway. And I think the council's made that repeatedly clear, frankly, over the last year with the amount of time and energy that they've put into sectors. So that should be a fairly easy thing to reaffirm for the industry. And then on the common pool side, as long as we've got a range of alternatives in there at this point, then perhaps we shouldn't be having the argument about which one we're going to choose right now, and not be in any way prejudging where we might end up with this. Let's just make sure we have all the alternatives that everyone thinks are reasonable and viable, and I do think that a hard tack alternative for the common pool vessels should be one of them.
Let me try this from a different perspective. I was not arguing for one alternative for common pool that shuts the fishery, the common pool down when a number is hit. I was thinking of it from a different perspective, which is to say, let's have a scenario here. The majority of people join groundfish sectors in 2010. None of those groundfish sectors exceed any one of their TACs in a given year. How do we know what the impact of the common pool has been from one year to the next? That's the first question. The second question is, when will we know whether or not the common pool has gone over the balance of what's left over? The third question is, can somebody then in the common pool that participated in this scenario, that participated in taking too much as a member of the common pool, then jump into a sector? Or the other way around? I think we've answered the other way around question, or at least there's an alternative that says if a sector exceeds its quota, people can't jump out of it into another sector or into the common pool. I'm looking at this from the perspective of a ledger, of a balance sheet, and getting away from where we've been for 15 years, which is whether you had a responsibility in over-harvesting or one stock or another, everybody took a whack. And that we're moving towards a place where you're responsible for your impacts and nothing more. At least that's my understanding. My understanding is that you're accountable for your actions. If you screw up, you pay for it. So I'm just trying to understand how the common pool's actions are dealt with in the context of this management plan. And my suggestion about hard tack, perhaps that's not the right word or right phrase. It's a charged phrase. What I'm suggesting is this document perhaps isn't fully developed with respect to how we address the common pool if and when it exceeds its share. Because it's going to get a share. There's an ACL. There's allocation to sectors on an annual basis. And then there's recreational and assumed state. We've had this discussion. But there's a number that belongs to the common pool. How do we deal with that? Tom, you have the answer?
Well, yeah, I think I do, to be honest. I mean, not that it's completely fleshed out, but there are options in the paper that talk on how to deal with it. The first is the option that says if the common pool approaches an ACL and it's predicted it'll go over, that there are closures that are implemented, and this is evaluated on a quarterly basis. In answer to the regional administrator's question, the motion that the council passed to put that in the document specifically included the language that said it's clarified that the intent of this motion is for the hard tack to be developed as a backstop to the effort control system and not as a standalone hard tack alternative. So that's why I've got it written in the document currently where it's spelled out as an accountability measure rather than a standalone alternative for a hard tack. And that was based on the fact that in June, a council meeting before this particular vote, the council had said they weren't going to put a hard tack alternative in this amendment, a standalone hard tack alternative. They'd consider it in the form of sectors. But then moving on to your question, I mean, so that addresses it one way, potentially, if the council chooses it that way. The other way that it's addressed potentially is through the adjustment of days at sea in the following year. Now, that, I think, has less certainty, perhaps, than the hard tack method in making sure you don't go over. And what that implies to me is that as that ACL is developed, there be the consideration that there's more management uncertainty built in as that is set, so you know the level of the ACL that triggers those types of days at sea adjustments. And I, you know, I can't sit here and tell you that we can precisely say what that level will be at least the first year or two when we do it. That's going to be a little bit hit or miss. The reality is that I don't think you can ever be certain that you're never going to suffer because somebody else went over. You know, the reality is that if the overage is bad enough, that everybody's going to suffer. We can do as much as we can, perhaps, to minimize the impacts of competing groups affecting each other, but I don't know that we can ever completely eliminate them. There are options in the document right now that do, and I haven't read them in a while, so I won't try and spell them out, but there are some options that do address the situation of what happens if sector goes over. And, you know, can someone move out of a sector or, you know, what can a whole sector disband and thereby avoid the punishment of going over? You're right in that I don't think there are any particular limits on whether someone can exit the common pool and join a sector in the following year. That's not in the document at present.
I know the committee has a meeting at the end of the month. I'd suggest you consider that issue. Dave Preble.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Upon reflection, I would like to withdraw my approval of the second, if it includes in Amendment 17.
We've had a long debate on this. I don't think you can, Dave. I don't think so. It's been debated. Thank you. Anything further from the council? Dave Gadel?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's this third scenario, John, that we still have to put up on the table, and that's the guy who's stuck in the common pool, who can't, for whatever reason, no sector wants him. He realizes he's in an impossible position now. We put in a hard tack, or we say, once you're in the common pool, you're in it forever until all the overages are paid back, as an example. He's in an impossible position, absolutely no win. Somehow we have to address that third alternative as well. And I understand why we made sectors self-selected, because of the joint and several liability issue. Nobody wants a lawbreaker in their sector. Somehow we have to address that. Now, whether it's through that joint and several liability aspect or it's through removing the self-selecting aspect of sectors, I'm not sure which way it should go or has to go, but it has to be addressed under this scenario if we vote this up.
Rip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to make a motion to amend to add just prior to 17, add 16 and 17.
Is there a second? Seconded by Rodney. Discussion on the motion to amend? Dave Pierce.
Well, I think it confuses the issue because it suggests to me that in 16 and in 7 we could have a mix, you know, because we're moving towards, because 16 has a mix. It has a mix of output-based and those that are not output-based. So we have to be clear about 17. I was looking at the motion, the original motion, as saying We're going to output-based in 17. That's it. No mix. It's going to be solely output-based. So that's my concern about the motion to amend, Rip. I'm not sure if you're clear enough as to what your intentions are.
I read it as that we already know that we have moved toward output-based management in 16. So that's implied to me. If you left no language, it's implied that it's in both of them. I find it if we just narrow it to 17, we're saying we're not doing anything of that sort in Amendment 16, when in fact we are.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, that's correct. We are, and everyone knows that. Therefore, the motion doesn't have any meaning to me. The motion to amend, and I don't think it would have any meaning to anyone who really is paying attention to what's going on with Amendment 16.
Counsel. Rodney?
Yeah, to that point, that's just what it does. It informs the group of people that don't come here and are not informed what this council's intentions are. That's just what it does.
Sally?
Yeah, agreed. I think this says plenty. It might be really, really simple and seem obvious to people in this room, but I think the message has been unclear, and that was described in at the end of the last advisory panel meeting summary, page 5 and 6, that this needed to be clarified. So as simple as it may seem, we need this. We need to be clarifying this.
Anyone else on the council? Mark Gibson.
I think this more accurately reflects what's actually happening. I would just suggest some wordsmithing to the effect that management system, beginning with Amendment 16, to be further developed in Amendment 17. I think that states very clearly what's happening and what our intent is.
Rodney, you okay with that? He added a little language. Begin in 16 and continue in 17. Okay. Anyone else on the council? Tom Neese.
I'd just like to ask a question on the language of the motion and just put a what if and make sure I understand how this thing is worded, if should it pass. Is it consistent with this motion, for example, if Amendment 16 includes sectors which are controlled by output controls but relies on days at sea and some sort of day at sea accountability measure for the common pool? Do council members think that's consistent with this motion?
Dave.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Particularly in answer to what Tom said, yes, it is consistent because it says it is the intent to move toward it. It doesn't exclude having the common pool in there. And I think that this is very close to where I was trying to go in the very first place. I think that Doug Grout's original motion says it well, but this specifies it precisely, and I think it's about where I really wanted to go.
Anyone else in the council? Go to the audience. Anyone in the audience? Maggie?
Well, since you're trying to send a message to the public, I guess I'll respond to what I think the message is. And I do not interpret from this motion what the scenario that Tom just outlined based on the discussion that's gone around this room. What I interpret is that the council is sending a message that the common pool will have a hard tack in that they will be managed primarily by a hard tack in Amendment 16. And, Associated Fisheries of Maine has been on the record for a long time saying that that's a bad way to manage the crownfish resource. We have experience with it. It doesn't work. And that's why we submitted a comprehensive ITQ proposal, because we saw that the council was moving towards hard tack management, and there had to be a responsible way to deal with a hard tack. And a Derby fishery is not a responsible way to do that. So if you do agree with the scenario that Tom outlined, I'd like to see that included in some of the language around the intent specifically of this motion. Thank you.
Anyone else? Back to the council. Jim Allen.
Yeah, I'd like to go back to my comment that, you know, even though people can still get in and out of the 19 existing sectors, I think that the 19 existing sectors effectively are maxed out with membership. They're not going to be able to handle more or an influx of another, I don't know how many hundred boats, you know. Nobody knows. So you really have effectively cut off anybody that was thinking about being in the common pool from deciding to form a new sector, or to maybe a few can join, but I think there's a limit of how many boats can be in these sectors. So I just have a concern with that. I think that if we're going to do something like this and put potential shutdowns to the common pool, we need to figure out a mechanism to reopen sectors. In other words, there may be five or six more that are needed to accommodate the whole fisheries. I don't know the number. Nobody knows the number. But I have a sense from being involved in most of the sector discussions with a lot of these people that are forming them that they very well could be maxed out to what they can handle as far as membership. So that's what I'm worried about. I'm worried that we've effectively no longer have a voluntary system because we've shut down more sectors, and now we're cramming the common pool people without the option of voluntarily forming a sector. We've taken that away from them, and we need to somehow put that back. Thank you.
Brett.
Thank you. If I may, Mr. Chairman, ask Jim just a question, and that is, How does this motion affect just what you said? I think what you said, at least to my thinking, isn't affected by what we're doing here. It's affected by some of the things that have already taken place.
Well, at the end of the day, it's going to depend on which option we pick out of Amendment 16, right? But to me, this is directing you to a particular option. In Amendment 16, it's just the way I read it. It's not in the words. It's implied. So that's why I feel that way. Thank you. That it's sending you to one of those options, and one of them is an option that the people didn't think they may had to have. And then so then they may have made a different choice back 6 months ago and joined a sector. You know, some people truly thought we were going to have a portion of the fisheries be able to stay in the days at sea. I mean, we've told them that. So I just think we need to have, and if we're taking an extra, some more time, we need to figure out if there's time to open sectors back up for some people that may want to form one. That's it. Thank you.
Anyone else on the council? Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Four opposed. No abstentions. Motion carries 13 to 4. Now it's the main motion. Anything further? Dave Gable.
To Jim's point, now that we've made our intent pretty clear, what are our options to deal with the issue that he's raised? Can the Groundfish Committee revisit this? Is it too late? I guess I need some, I don't know, maybe Pat would be the one to answer this. If she says the council did it, can the council undo it, or is it too late to undo it? Can we allow people to form more sectors? I agree with Jim. I think most of the sectors are maxed out. You start getting into the percentages and the quotas and everything else, I believe you're going to find that they can't absorb out of, what is 19, was it 19 sectors? I don't think they can all absorb 20 more boats apiece. And I think that's on the order of what we're talking here. So, and that's if they spread out evenly. So there's the, all the issues we've raised, the two of us have raised here in the last 15 minutes, how are we going to deal with them?
As to the issue of maximum percentage, I believe there's an alternative that lifts the percentage. So as to that being a limiter, the council could make a decision that removes that cap or adjusts that cap. As far as entertaining new sector applications, I'm not sure. I'd have to talk to, I guess, the service and probably the Groundfish Committee as well to see what the practical implications are of reopening the application process.
Okay, and the other one was the self-selecting aspect. You know, even if you can't form new sectors and it's self-selecting, even if we lift the amount of fish that can be controlled by one sector, they could still self-select, so they can still choose to exclude people for whatever reason. It could be anything. It could be anything. That, to me, is the most important one, because I think that's the one that's ultimately going to determine who ends up where.
Jackie?
Jackie O'Dell, Northeast Seafood Coalition. Being the part of an organization that is sponsoring the development of 13 sectors, I just thought I would remind the council that after we proposed those 13 sectors, we spent probably close to a year arguing with various people why we needed to support so many sectors, and spent a considerable amount of time talking with people about why we couldn't consolidate those sectors and how, you know, 13 was too many. How could you guys maybe bring that down to 6 or 2 or 3? And I spent a year talking to people about why we submitted so many sectors and the purpose of doing so. And now to be sitting here a year and a half later after we proposed those sectors, and I've spent that time talking with people, to sit here and listen to the council talk about adding additional sectors, I just find that to be very interesting and have to note that. And I really hope that at some point, I know it's important to have the council have a discussion of vision and where we're heading and what's going on, but the Groundfish Advisors talked about that, you know, that one sentence that's in the minutes from the GAP was talked about for maybe, I don't know, maybe 5 minutes, and we've spent 4 or 5 hours today at the council talking about that and putting a lot of emphasis on that, when we actually talked more about the cap and removing the cap and the for the days at sea leasing program and the permit history issues. And so I really hope at some point we're going to get back to the discussion of the PDT's report, the tables, and you know, what's going on with Amendment 16, because that's really the reason why a lot of us came here today. Thank you.
Rich.
Rich Kanash, thank you. I have to agree with Jackie, being a GAP advisor. You know, that's what we focused on. We spent very little time on what's being discussed now. But, again, it's allocation, the allocation process, and having two types of sectors or even days at sea. When you're dealing with apples, oranges, bananas, and pineapples, if we're not on the same currency, we're going to have this problem until Dr. Pierce passes away. But I have a thought, and maybe some of you people remember this. It's called fish stamps. It's a new name. It's a new thing out there. It's a new management system. It's called fish stamps. I just didn't want to say point system.
Okay, we're back on the main motion as amended. Anything further? Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Twelve. Opposed? Four. Five. Motion carries 12-5. Whip?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe the other issue that we have outstanding is to do with a liability question that was brought up by the GAP earlier. To that end, and to direct the discussion, I have a motion to make. This is not a committee motion. It's one that I'm making. I move that the council recommend, and it would be to the service, that the last sentence in the current regulations end after the word requirements. If you look at the sheet that was handed out by Maggie, you'll see that last sentence is highlighted, and after requirements would be eliminated.
Is there a second? Seconded by Terry. Gene Martin.
Just a point of clarification. You mean you're recommending that NMFS eliminate it now as a regulatory action, or that Amendment 16 suggests that that is how it should be?
It should be Amendment 16.
Discussion. David.
No, I'm sorry. Are we talking about the highlighted sheet here? And where's the word requirement?
Under current regulations, the last sentence is highlighted. The requirements is halfway through. It's in the third line.
Okay, requirements was in there. I'm sorry. That's why I didn't understand. All right, see. You would propose to strike the language as well as any other applicable federal regulations resulting in from there on, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Tommy?
I'm going to turn to Gene. I guess my question is, don't you really want to put a comma after requirements and then keep the part resulting in assessment of civil permits and whatever that language is, civil penalties and permit sanctions? Or is that not really needed? I mean, I think the part we want to pull out, the council is considering pulling out, is this section that says, as well as any other applicable federal regs. But then there's
That is correct. That last part is really sort of it actually narrows it to fishing regulations.
Karen, did you get that thing?
Does the seconder agree? The change? Okay. Jim Alden?
I think I'm in support of this, but
and not seeing everybody's, have not read all these sector plans, difficult, because I think some people may say in a sector plan, look, you're not supposed to operate in a closed area, even though they can, I'm just using that as a for instance, you're not supposed to operate in a closed area and you're supposed to abide by all the other rules. I think the sector plans are pretty broad in that sense. So that, is that a sector plan requirement? If you see, and so then by doing this, we still have, I suppose that people's sector plans will change now, and that they will only, their rules and requirements will only pertain to reporting and other stuff. So it's a question, I guess, I'm throwing out to the maker of the motion that still may be too broad. I'm afraid that I think we want sector regulations to encompass everything, because we'd like the sector to say we want you people to, we want your sector members to abide by all the regulations. However, we're only joint and severally responsible for X, Y, and Z, because you want to encourage compliance with all laws. But if we do it this way, they're going to take that out of their operations plans and their intent of how they want to operate. I'm not sure I'm being clear in what I'm saying, but it's still broad, and I suppose that sector plans will adjust themselves to fix this, to meet this. But I think then we lose some of the intent of the sectors. You know, you want to operate sustainably and all that. So,
Dave.
Yeah, I think there are a number of sector lawyers working on this right now. I think there are people that are involved in forming the sectors that are working on legal language to resolve this, and I'm not sure that it serves us well today to spend a lot of time on that when they may have it resolved by the next council meeting. I'm not really prepared to speak on it because I don't know, but I've been told that there's supposed to be a meeting between general counsel and some of the sector lawyers to try and resolve this in the near future, to come up with language that's mutually agreeable. I think there are people in the audience that might be able to speak to that.
Well, from my standpoint, it would be great if we could have that language actually by our time of or before our next committee meeting. But I don't know.
Well, that's what I was told this morning, is that they're having a meeting, and I don't know when it is. But again, if you went to the public, you might be able to get the answer to that question.
Gene?
Well, I haven't heard of such a meeting myself. I don't know if that's on a national scale or something else, but I haven't been informed of that meeting. Maybe a way out of this is to, instead of trying to come up with specific language at this point, is just to convey the intent that joint and several liability is intended to apply to those requirements that, are integral and essential to the sector operations plan. You could even go so far as to require that each operations plan has a section in there that identifies what the sector considers to be integral to the sector operations plan. Now, that would have to basically be negotiated between the service and the sector every time a new sector comes into being. I mean, if the sector operations plan was too narrow in what it defines based on what NIMS' view is on this, then we could hopefully come to an agreement to identify those kinds of common measures that we think are really integral to a plan. And if a sector wants to be even broader for whatever reason, then, that would probably always be acceptable to National Marine Fisheries Service.
If we added in to Amendment 16 and we have some alternatives under sector policy that do address that, but if we use that language, would that, do you think, solve the problem?
You mean as an alternative?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, just, let this be worked out more at the committee level
You know, I'd like to consult with the enforcement attorneys that would actually be enforcing or applying this principle. And by the way, their position on this is, you know, they don't think they'd ever seek joint and several liability unless it was really connected to the operations plan. But that can be cold comfort in advance. So, you know, they're not, you know, straining at the bit to look for joint and several liability for totally unrelated kinds of activities, because they don't think that's going to be a winner in court. But nevertheless, they want the option in those cases where they do think it's appropriate to. And I think the sector, and I think the concept of sector operation, I mean, sector management needs that kind of incentive for the sector participants to self-police, et cetera, to the point that it's really integral to this, to the way the sector operates.
It seems to me that after that discussion that this is something that the committee should try and work on additionally. I guess I would go without objection. We would return this to be further worked on by the committee at the next meeting.
Okay, that's what we'll do. Then we'll put this issue back on the docket for the committee. Anything further, Rip? Yeah, the motion's withdrawn without objection. Tom, are there other items in the document you wanted, the draft document you want to draw the council's attention to? I noticed there were some shaded blocks, and I'm not sure if your original intent was to have had the committee meeting that was canceled address those and then come to the council with it or not. And is there utility in having the council take a look at some of that shaded text?
I'm not sure there is. It's not clear to me that whether or not the discussion on the PDT report was finished. I mean, I had presented everything that I wanted to present, but I don't know if there were still outstanding questions.
Turn to the council. Are there items within the PDT report? There are at least three. Jim Odlin.
Yeah, I had a couple of questions, Tom, on some of the tables. For instance, that we didn't get to before lunch. And give me just... if I look at Table 5, and under Pollock, it says we need a 48% reduction in Amendment 16. I can't understand the counts... Based on what? Based on how long of rebuilding period? Based on, and then to follow that, we have a letter saying that, answering a letter we wrote, the council wrote, regarding Pollock that says they incorrectly used the single fall survey biomass index from 2007 when it appears they should have used 3-year running average or a 3-year centered average. So the question is, how did you come up with the 48%? What rebuilding periods are in that? And does that reflect the letter that we got from the service stating that the Pollock calculation in the GARM report is wrong?
Well, see if I can answer those in exactly the reverse order. No, it does not reflect the letter that we got. This work was done before we got the letter. The rebuilding period was an example rebuilding period that's reflected in Table 7, which calculated a median probability of success by 2018 for Pollock, and that's where the number came from. So I did get them in order, the three questions. So, yeah, I mean, this conceivably, that number would change if the stock does turn out to be overfished after the 2008 trawl survey index comes in. It would depend on what rebuilding period the council chose and what probability of success and what the current F was. But that's where that number came from. It should be, it is the same number that's in Table 7. But I'm actually glad that you brought that up, because that was one thing that was in the present, it was not in my presentation, that I wanted to highlight. And this is just to indicate to you that the exact reductions that are needed, at least for these three stocks, depends on what choices are made for the different allocations between the recreational and commercial fishery, which is a separate decision. But the decisions the council makes on that will determine what sort of reduction is needed for each component of the fishery. They won't necessarily be the same, unlike Framework 42, where for Gulf of Maine cod we targeted the same reduction for both the commercial and recreational component. If the council chooses to make a commercial recreational allocation, you could wind up with different reductions for each of those components depending on the decisions you make there. That's what this table was trying to illustrate. We didn't put winter flounder in this table because we expect almost without a doubt that winter flounder will not be given an allocation once you take into account the proportion of the recreational harvest that comes in out of state waters. It will not meet the 5% in federal waters that is in the document at present.
Dr. Pierce.
Regarding the tables that you've assembled, Tom, well, Mr. Chairman, I hope that the audience will be given a chance to ask some questions about this document as well. I know a few individuals have expressed some concern, need for clarification, so I hope that they'll get a chance to ask some questions. To Table 7, Gulf of Maine codfish, I note that 2007 catch, about 5,270 metric tons, and then the PDT estimates the 2008 catch is about 8,000 metric tons, so it went up rather dramatically. And now for 2009 estimated catch, we go up again about 2,300 metric tons. My question to you, Tom, is can the plan development team specifically provide us with an analysis, recognizing that you're strapped for cash, so to speak. You have no people working with you now because they're working on the interim action. But would the plan development team be able to give us some insight through some analyses regarding whether this increase in Gulf of Maine catch from 2007 to 2008 was due to increased catch per effort or due to increased fishing effort? If you recall, years ago now, before Framework 42 was implemented, many individuals from the industry, myself included, made the point that we thought that Framework 42 would actually increase effort on Gulf of Maine codfish, and that was something we didn't want to have happen. If it's increased catch per effort, then I can live with that. I can understand it. I can deal with it. But if it's an actual increased effort, fishing effort that's caused that increased catch, then we have to know that and then anticipate that continued increased effort, perhaps, with the next amendment. So is it possible to do that analysis, to make that distinction between as to what caused that increase in catch?
Let's be accurate. Whether this increase in catch, got to be careful here. This increase in the estimate of 2008 catch, to be precise, is almost entirely a result of increases in commercial landings that took place from January through June. I shouldn't say it is almost. I mean, it is entirely. We use the same discard rate as in 2007, so there's no change in the discard rate in this particular analysis. And we use the same recreational harvest, so there's no change in the recreational. I guess it would be possible to go back and look at the first 6 months of the year and do some evaluations on numbers of trips and days at sea used and that kind of thing in the Gulf of Maine area and compare that to the previous year and perhaps draw some conclusions about whether it represents increased effort. That's not a particularly difficult analysis to do, I don't think. It's a little bit tedious, but it's not really hard.
Okay, I'm not in a position to instruct the plan development team. Is that something that you can do, Tom, and that you will do, or do you need a specific motion from the council to request that analysis? I don't want to be burdensome.
You know, I think we can probably do something. I think it's an interesting question.
Dave Gaither.
Yes. Actually, what I wanted to discuss is to see if we need a motion today to deal with the issue of the newly identified stocks and their rebuilding time periods. It's specific to Tom's bullet number 6 in this document on page 5. He has provided examples, assuming a rebuilding time period of 10 years from today. But if I read this, if I understand this, I assume we're the ones who actually picked the rebuilding time period, and then we have to agree on the percentage of success, you know, whether it's 50 or 75, what our preferred alternative is. So that's why I asked about T-Mins way back at the beginning of this whole day at about 8:30 this morning. And, I mean, I think we have to address this issue today because I don't see how you can go forward until you do. But I may be wrong.
I actually think the council did give us the guidance for that at the last council meeting. We are working on projections where we figure out how long a rebuilding period is needed with no fishing mortality to rebuild with a 75% probability. So that basically gives the team in at a 75% probability of success. And then we're doing 10-year rebuilding at both a median and 75% probability of success. So that gives you, for all of these stocks anyway, that gives you your maximum rebuilding period. And then the suggestion of the council was to come up with something in between. And as I recall the discussion, the council was suggesting, you know, consider biological characteristics of the stocks and see if there's something that jumps out at you at what might be a reasonable period to rebuild in between the minimum and the maximum at a 75% probability of success. The PDT is actually taking that a little bit further than that, and when we do that analysis, it's not me. When the center does that analysis, the center folks, they're going to take a look at it and see in that intervening period which period, if there's any difference in net benefits that result from different rebuilding periods. Those may be pretty fine differences, considering I think we're probably talking about the difference between, you know, 7 and 8 years or 6 and 9 years. I don't think there'll be huge differences when we start looking at that. We had about half of that done, have to redo some stuff, and I think we'll have that done for the – I'm hopeful that we'll have that done for the committee. And then the council will be able to choose which options they want to go forward with in the draft document. And you may want to consider, as you did with Amendment 13, you considered a couple different options for rebuilding plans and then chose for the final one at the end.
Anyone else on the council? Dr. Pierce requested that I go to the audience. And that's what I'm going to do. Anyone in the audience? Vito.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Vito Giuliani, Northeast Seafood Coalition. Just wanted to take a minute to reinforce what was said earlier. It said a lot of things, but basically on the looking at the differences, the changes in mortality that are achieved out of the CAM through Framework 42, I think the projection for 2008 catch makes a lot of sense. But it's an entirely different thing when the prediction of how much catch or what the mortality changes will be in future years actually occurs. And we've done just a brief comparison of TACs, and I realize now in retrospective patterns that the closed area model actually protected those stocks inadvertently by ratcheting catch way down below what we knew that catches would end up being way below what the TACs were. And that ended up being okay. But we're not going to allocate that way in the future. And I think the ACLs are going to be set at a much more precautionary level. We already have retrospective patterns built into these ACLs. So I'm just cautioning. We believe that, the straight use of the closed area model alone is going to be, we believe, very dangerous to OI. And I think we have to really look at how those differences in catches have occurred. Dr. Pierce brought up a very good point. If anyone recalls Framework 42, we had stated emphatically that 2-to-1 counting, the differential counting, is the cause for increased effort on Georgia, on Gulf of Maine cod. There's no question about that. When you cut your days to a critical minimum, or you make it so that there is nothing else that you can do in a certain area, you're direct on cod, and that's what's happened. So there was a pretty extensive analysis for Framework 42 that actually looked at how many permits were contributing to what percentage of the catch, and it was 52 or 60 vessels that were basically doing nothing but concentrating on cod for the previous 3 years. And we had just speculated when you go to 2-to-1, you're going to end up cutting half the days. You're going to have all of the OI forfeited on most all the other stocks. Even the closed area model showed that. But you are not going to protect cod, because what you're going to do is you're going to have, instead of having 50 or 60 people focusing on cod, you're going to have 150, 160 people focusing on cod. And that's exactly what happened. So I think the suggestion to have a look-see at, at what is really causing the increased cod catches, I think it's the result of the 2-to-1 differential. So, again, we'd like to caution, radical changes in input controls are going to be very difficult to understand. Once you whack that hornet's nest so hard, you don't know where the hornets go. Tweaks work. You start getting radical with with how the inputs work, I think it's going to get dangerous. So we would definitely support consideration of either trip limit triggers like we do on Georges Bank for the three sharing stocks and the trip limit triggers that were proposed before as inputs to look at. So my comment is to be very cautious of how we continue to use the closed area model, which, by the way, we think is a fantastic model for what it was built for, and we've outgrown, just like the days at sea system needs to be changed radically, that tool, we have to be very careful in how we're using it. So that's my comment.
Vito, are your comments directed at Amendment 16 or the interim action as well?
Thank you for asking that, because both. Basically, I think the dependence on what the closed area model puts out for changes in exploitation rate is an entirely different thing if we're going towards ACLs, and that the TACs that are going to be used to be input into this model are now the result of TACs that have been adjusted for retrospective patterns. So we're just saying to reinforce the closed area model, it would be good to have some type of backstop that, like the payback provision, and those types of things. And also the motion that was adopted 12-4 a little while ago for Amendment 16, same idea. I think using payback provisions, not hard tax, and Derby fishery type of thing, but payback provisions would be preferable than to go totally relying on the closed area model and coming up with, huge days at sea cuts and ratchets. They're going to have distorted results. I mean, we used worse words than that in Framework 42. And, quite frankly, the under yields are, on some stocks and the waste on others is a perfect example of what proved out.
Anyone else in the audience? Okay. Back to the council. Jamala?
Yeah, Fido's comments made me bring something to my mind, is that when we look at Pollock, both in the interim rule and in, and I'm not sure if the interim rule is going to address Pollock. I hope not, because it's a newly determined fisheries that I guess isn't quite determined yet. But in the case of Pollock, we may, in the interim rule, knowing that we have some kind of problem, stop fishing Pollock on a B-day. I think that would be the starting spot. because it's increased the effort on Pollock. So it's similar to what Vito's saying. Thank you.
Anyone else? Rip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I hope this is not presumptuous, but in Franco was used to have a little saying for the day to get us started on all of these meetings. And I thought maybe something in terms of what you find in fortune cookies would be something good for a closing thought for us. A good memory is fine, but the ability to forget is the one true test of greatness.
Dave Gaethel.
Two more things, Mr. Chair. One is that based on the discussions I've heard around the table today that people can still add permits to sectors at this time, I think we should make the public aware of that because I don't think the public understands that they can still add sectors to get their catch history and whatnot. If that's not correct, I'd like to hear it so that the public is aware.
Not to speak for the council, but I think what the council said earlier is people can still join sectors, but I didn't hear the council say any statement that new sectors could form.
That's what I said, add permits to sectors, which is to join sectors. That's not to form new sectors. I just want to affirm that that's true.
I don't know. Mark Grant isn't here, but he's the sector Jedi. Tom?
I don't want to speak for NIMS, but I thought they sent out a letter already saying that they've moved those dates forward, you know, when you have to be committed into a sector, when the sector lists have to be finalized. And I don't remember exactly what they were.
I think for this year it was October 1st for 2009. For the two existing sectors, they had to have their...
Yeah, but for the Amendment 16 sectors, I thought it was next spring sometime.
Okay. I'm not sure what the exact date is, Dave. We should, somebody here should be able to figure that out.
Okay. And the other question I had, and I realize this revolves pulling back the curtain, but the industry really needs to know what this interim rule is going to be as soon as possible. People are trying to make business decisions and fishery decisions in this year to be able to carry over days perhaps to next year when they may need them a lot more. So have we got any update on when the curtain's going to be pulled back?
No, I don't have any update. I would hope that if we're going to take action, we'd see something in November sometime, but that's probably the closest I could guess. But that would be a proposed rule at that stage.
Okay, that's fine. That's, at least it gives me something to go home and tell people that, you know, hopefully maybe before the end of the year they might see a proposed rule as opposed to it's going to be April 30th of 2009 that they're going to see the rule.
Anyone else on the council? Maggie?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wasn't here on Tuesday when the council did their reports, but it's my understanding that the National Marine Fisheries Service did not report to the council that at the 30th annual meeting of NAFO that the U.S. did achieve its longstanding goal of trying to acquire fishing opportunity on the Grand Banks for Georges Bank yellowtail. That opportunity will be available in 2009. And my question for Pat was, when does she have any idea when that opportunity will be announced to the public and what the regulations, if any, will be for vessels that want to participate in that opportunity?
I'd actually refer it to Gene. He knows more about it than I do, and I would be guessing.
I think we have to go through a Federal Register notice to announce it, and right now that I'm not aware of a specific time frame. As soon as possible, I think is the best answer to make sure that happens. But it would have to be announced in the Federal Register to see what support there is for it. Because under the NAFO arrangement, as you know, we have to, the U.S. actually has to request the transfer. It's not an automatic transfer. And so we would probably want to go through the Federal Register notice, see if there's any public support or interest in harvesting it, and then if there is, go through the process of requesting it. But I believe, I have to go back and look, I think there's a time frame when we have to request it of Canada. I can't remember if you remember, Maggie, if it's January 1st.
I don't recall that the agreement had an exact date in it for the request, but obviously we're getting pretty close to the year 2009,
right.
And so we should probably try to get that.
Yeah, I will. I will remind our headquarters that's handling this of the time frame.
Okay, thank you.
Dave Preble.
Yeah, are we down to the last issue here now? Because I have one more thing I want to bring up. Okay. I'd like to reference a document in tab 3, document 8F. This is the letter to the Inspector General. And I think it's a letter that, for a number of reasons, I think the Council needs to respond to this. I think it goes way past the line that we can accept. The nature of science is that it self-corrects its errors, bearing in mind that all humans make errors. And it does that with the process called peer review, which is a brutal process. It's not a process that anybody lightly wants to go through. And in fact, Thomas Huxley, referring to that more than a century ago, said that the great tragedy of science is a beautiful theory destroyed by an ugly fact. And that's the way science works. Before GARM 3 was released, there were calls for peer review of the results of GARM 3 before it was even released. Once it was released, it became evident that an extensive peer review had already been done. So then the next thing that happened was that the attack was changed from an attack upon science to an attack upon the scientists. And the attack was against the integrity of the scientists that we have worked with for a long time, many of us for many years. I'd like to point out in the letter some of the things that I find to be particularly obnoxious. On the first page, it says, this is just inaccurate. I'll get to obnoxious afterwards. In a New England ground fishery, many stakeholders alleged that biomass targets have been set unrealistically high. In fact, GARM 3 reduced the biomass targets by more than 30%. It then goes on to say that scientific protocol is not followed. In fact, this was thoroughly peer-reviewed. It's hard to imagine that anybody could even make that statement. And we can argue the science. We can criticize the science. That's how science works. I have no problem with criticizing the science. But then we go on to the next page, and it says at the top that Senate staff have taken unwarranted liberties regarding the legal interpretation of regulations. What that says is that they violated the law. If we go on to the next paragraph, it says that there are concerns about the veracity of the Science Center's scientific data and conclusions. Veracity is a word that means they lied. This letter calls people like Paul Rego and Mike Fogarty criminals and liars. That's what this letter says. I find that inconceivably obnoxious. I could let this go as being just another political screed, but it does affect this council. I can't tell you how angry I am with this. I've known Mike Fogarty for more than a third of a century. When he was an undergraduate, he worked for me when I was a young fishery biologist. I followed his career for years. There's no more honorable man on this planet. Yet this letter attacks his basic personal integrity. Not his ability with science, but his personal integrity. The reason I think the council needs to respond is because a number of things have happened. First of all, if we're silent, that's our assent. If we're silent, that means that we agree with it, or at least we don't think it's that important. I do think it's important. We have to work with these scientists, and now they're going to be tied up with an investigation by an IG. An IG's function is to investigate malfeasance and violation of law. This is not a scientific peer review. This is a witch hunt. And I think it's despicable. And I would like this council, I'm too angry to get into it myself, but I think that we need to have some kind of a letter sent out publicly. I think the letter should go to the director of the Northeast Fisheries Science Center. I think the letter should say that while this council understands the function of science, that this particular letter is well beyond a simple criticism of science, and that we disavow it, and that we support the integrity of the scientists involved. We don't have to support the science. Science works by constantly being questioned. It takes into account human error, human frailty, but it self-corrects. That's why we manage by science. But this letter is unacceptable. It should be unacceptable to this council, and I would like to have this council send a letter and make a statement to that effect. Thank you.
Other council members care to comment on the letter or share the same feelings or concerns? Mark Gibson.
Yeah, I share some of Dave's feelings, and perhaps not quite so strongly, but I do think there needs to be some expression. I mean, I tried to express it when the Grom 3 results were originally presented at the Providence meeting, but I think some support for the individuals and the institution that does that work needs to be expressed in view of where that letter went. He's right. It wasn't requesting a peer review. It was requesting Inspector General to look into this, and that's an entirely different process than is, another group of scientists from somewhere else around the world to look at this.
Paul Howard.
Just a couple things. Nothing to do with this letter, but you should know that right after the GARM and right after the presentation, staff sent a letter under my signature to Nancy, thanking her for all the hard work over the summer and for the good report, the report that Paul gave and everything. So we did thank them for the GARM work. And secondly, the presentation for RIP testifying to Senator Snow on Tuesday contains an awful lot of praise for the Science Center work in the GARM.
Dr. Pierce.
Clearly, we believe that the scientists of the Northeast Fisheries Science Center are top notch. They've done excellent work, and clearly, they did the best that they could do with the data that they had in their hands. And I'm not going to suggest that a letter be written in response to this particular letter that was signed by Senator Snow and Kerry and Kennedy and Collins. They're responding on behalf of constituents and inquiring, making some legitimate inquiries. I think their letter is quite appropriate. I have no problem with it whatsoever. And then we'll just see how it all plays out. I'll be the last one to question the motivations of those good senators.
Sally.
Yeah, I think that even though the council has expressed support for the Science Center in early September and May again during the hearing next week in Portland, that it's worth expressing the positive sentiment again to the Science Center in light of this letter, though perhaps not necessarily directly in response to this letter. I don't think that it would hurt to publicly express that support again because of this letter, but I would hate for the council to get too tangled up in the politics of this and rather just stick to a message of, understanding the complexities of the stock assessments and appreciating the thoroughness of the peer review that was conducted over the past year and concluding this summer. So that's something that I would suggest and think that it's appropriate. And even if it means reiterating something that was said in the letter that was just sent a month ago, I think it's absolutely worth sending.
Anyone else on the council? Doug?
I would support a letter of support to the Science Center. As I realize we've said it before, but in light of this letter from the senators, I think we need to express our support of the fine work that they've done with this assessment.
Jim Fair.
I agree with Dave's sentiments wholeheartedly. I think that we really need to respond to this because it hasn't again questioned the validity of the work. It's questioning the honesty and the integrity of the people that did the work. And I don't understand where that's coming from. But I'd like to know. But I just think it would be appropriate for this body to make some kind of a statement that we don't think that this type of insinuation by four U.S. senators is going to help the process in any way.
Dave Gettle.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with sending a letter of support, but I think if you read this carefully, it makes a number of potential accusations, I guess you'd call them. And then it says, we are not in a position to verify the accuracy of these allegations, but we believe that they warrant further investigation. Now, we could have an argument about whether this is the right group to do that investigation or not. I mean, I would suggest that the Center for Independent Experts would be the right people to review it, not the Inspector General's office, which are more geared towards bean counting. But, we're between a rock and a hard place here, no matter what we do, quite frankly. I mean, there is nothing, there are accusations being made, but they're also saying in the same letter that we are unable to verify or not verify those accusations. And I think beyond sending a letter saying that, we support the people involved, I think we're kind of overstepping our bounds because we may not be in a position to verify it any more than the senators are at this time. Or the inspector general. Again, I think it's the wrong people to be doing the verifying, but that's who they chose.
Rick Cunningham.
Thank you. I agree with Dave Gatel on this, and I think that a letter of support, as indicated by Sally, would be a good idea. I think going beyond that, as much as it would, there would be some self-satisfaction in doing so, I think it drags us down into the politics of this whole issue, and quite frankly, that was just the politics.
As Paul stated before, he penned a brief but appropriate letter to Nancy expressing our gratitude for the efforts that had gone into the GARM. If the council would like us to reiterate that again, we can do that. Is there any objection? Okay. Mary Beth?
Are we under other business now?
Well, at the risk of mentioning the word herring in today's agenda item after yesterday, I think I will.